Everybody, welcome to Each in the News. We've got Tyler Ferrari. He's a CISO at a company called Exabeam, and we're going to talk about some reporting that they did last year, some surveys, and what he does over at Exabeam. First of all, Tyler, welcome. How are you doing?
Hi, Dylan. I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
All right, well, let's jump into this. So, as a CISO, I mean, it's these days, Tyler, you know, a CISO's job is not easy. It's a lot of things that you have to do. Just to kind of give you a bit of your journey, how did you end up getting at Exabeam?
So I actually started off as a customer of Exabeam and really enjoyed the product and saw this opportunity and I couldn't pass it up. But kind of just to walk through my background really quickly, I was a naval officer for 11 years as a cryptologic warfare officer within U.S. Cyber Command. I transitioned out of the military. I consulted with KPMG. After KPMG, I worked for a clear defense contractor that specialized in the manufacturing of satellites and satellite imagery. And that's where I became a customer of Exabeam. And as you can imagine, with a defense contractor working in that space, you're talking about many of the most sophisticated nation state threat actors. And we needed a capability to be able to detect, again, this very sophisticated activity. And like I said, love the product, love the team that I was working with. The CISO role opened up and I applied for it. And that was over 2.5 years ago now. So I've been with Exabeam for almost 3 years.
Well, that's a stellar journey. So, Tyler, I mean, just as a quick question, what's it like, defending, in the military things, all these state actors? Like, what's a day in the life of what goes on there?
Every day is different. I think that's a good thing. You try to center yourself around a solid set of goals to achieve, a solid set of milestones to achieve throughout the year or throughout the quarter, et cetera. But you have to be very, very agile. As most folks are aware, things change every day. The landscape changes every day, and you could be that close to an email that says now there's a vulnerability or here's an alert, et cetera. So agility is very important in being flexible enough to really pivot quickly to address some of these new threats or issues.
Is there something, Tyler, that keeps you awake at night, knowing what you know? What keeps you awake at night? Or do you get a good night's sleep?
I think the joke is I sleep like a baby, but babies wake up all the time crying. So, I mean, I wouldn't say any one thing keeps me awake at night. Like I said, every day is different, and so as I experience a day, maybe something throughout that day stuck in my mind is in my subconsciousness, and it may wake me up at night. But I wouldn't say there's any one thing that continues to dig at my mind throughout the night to wake me up.
So that might be a good thing. So there's
Yeah.
hope. So you guys did a kind of I guess a state of a threat detection survey, and you dug in a little bit. Let's talk a bit about that report. First of all, what give me some details about the report, why you did it, and let's dig into what's in it.
It's called the State of the TDIR report. TDIR stands for Threat Detection, Investigation, and Response. And really, our primary goal was to try to shed some light on the evolving landscape of cybersecurity threats and also the defenses. And we did it from a global perspective. So we did survey folks from all over the world. And what we tried to do here was like bridge this gap between what is the perception and then the reality within cybersecurity operations. And we did it across, like I said, not only folks across the world, but different industries, different regions. And I think this report not only uncovers some of the existing disparities that are very popular in these security posture perceptions, but it also highlights some of the critical areas that do require some almost immediate attention and improvement.
So let's go through that. So, what's the one thing, if you wanted to pick just one thing that surprised you about perception versus reality?
The most striking finding, there's some apparent contradiction between the confidence in a survey taker's threat detection capability and then the actual incidence of significant security breaches. So we had 90% of organizations that believed that they were proficient in detecting cyber threats effectively, but then out of the same 90%, 57% of those reported also experiencing substantial security incidents that necessitated some sort of external expertise for resolution. So you have this discrepancy that really underscores this pervasive, what we call overconfidence, that can, you know, blindside an organization to thinking that they're not vulnerable to something because of their defenses.
You know, in some ways, you know, cyber experts, right? You know, they're confident in their skill set, and they've got a whole whack of tools, right, that they think are going to do everything they need to get it done. And they're sort of, you know, playing with a joystick, if you will, to make sure that all these things are humming properly. But in, at the end of the day, it's like what you don't know, right? And that's the part that that's sort of like, how do you know what you don't know, right?
Right. Yeah.
So are you finding that, the level of overconfidence, how do we deal with that, by the way? I mean, how do you bring people from the overconfident world to the, you know, real world? Is there a special magic bullet?
Well, I think that there's this concept that, like you said, we only know what we know, and we base decisions off of what we know. And I'm sure there's some bias that's introduced with no CISO, well, at least publicly say, I don't feel like I'm doing enough. Like, I think, and I think no person would say that. I think we're all trying the hardest that we can, and we're utilizing the resources that we have at our, you know, that's available to us. And do we, it's comes down to, do we feel good about it? And kind of the statement of, is it good enough? And so that's something that we're actually exploring more here at Exabeam, of like, well, what is good enough? And maybe that changes based off of the individual and the company, but we do want to really dig into that of what is good enough. Why is this, these survey results the way that they are, and what's really underneath that, that's really causing these survey takers to be very confident in their abilities, yet these breaches are still happening. And so, I think there's a couple things I'd recommend. I think one is that first acknowledging that there have been advancements and progress with organizations' security programs, and particularly within security operations. And part of that is with some of these new advanced security technologies. But if I were going to recommend something, I think it's shifting how we measure and report on our capabilities, and defining better metrics for threat detection, investigation, response. Maybe shifting away from some of the mean times to detect and respond, et cetera, and focusing more on some of the outcomes-based metrics that really shows this implementation of a robust validation process that really can stand out as a more strategic approach.
Yeah, makes sense. I mean, don't you find that, for me, you know, it seems like the CISO role is sort of morphing into something extraordinary. It wasn't like this a few years ago. Now they probably need to be having a role at the board level. They're not signing off on anything anymore because the CEO says so. You can, you know, there's some handcuffs involved if you do the wrong things, and there's compliance regulations. There's a lot more scrutiny, and there's a lot more eyeballs on what you do. And if you mess up, there are like serious consequences now, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe the answer too is these CISOs are kind of waking up to like, wait a minute, it's not just what I think, it's, you know, what I can prove, you know, that type of thing. Do you find that the landscape for a CISO has changed? And if so, what do you think the new role of a CISO is today?
I think the landscape has definitely changed. I don't know if everyone has woken up to that fact yet. And in many cases, it's still seen as this rosy red role. And you see a lot of folks that are going up in the cybersecurity world saying, I want to be a CISO one day. And you somewhat question that. It's like, are you not to challenge it to say you shouldn't be, but to actually question, are you sure that you want to be? And you want to be, like, you need to want to be a CISO because of all of the areas that you just listed. There's so much to really be aware of, and to balance. And you're right, you kind of have to be all of these things and more of the IT world. There's risk management. Like you said, there's board, there's public, reporting. It's a big, big responsibility. And so you really need to have the mindset and the awareness of all of these additional kind of responsibilities that fall on the CISO in order to be, maybe stay out of trouble.
Yeah. I mean, it's a new expanded C-suite, right? As a matter of fact, quite honestly, I really don't even see how companies can move forward in this digital transformation, this digital first world, right? Knowing all the cyber stuff that's going on, how do you go forward without a rock solid, strategy around protecting the family jewels, so to speak? But now you've got also the privacy issues to contend with, and these days people are stealing data, but they're not really using it. They're waiting until it can be decrypted, with quantum computing. And I mean, there's so many things that is happening right now, and we haven't even gotten to the state level yet and what they're up to. And it seems as well that the folks at the state level, when they discover something, they don't even really care to keep it a secret anymore. They're sharing it with the community so they can just wreak havoc, right, with everybody. Do you see dynamics of the mentality of those bad actors? Are they evolving? Are they changing? Like, what is it like today to be, to define a profile of a bad actor?
That's a really good question. I'll give you a quick story of how I think about it. I got a call a few weeks ago, stating that it was somebody from my local credit union and that my card had been compromised. After a few questions, you could tell that something didn't feel or smell right, but I did stick around long enough to have a conversation to get an idea of what was going on. And I'll tell you, for a person maybe outside of security or not very savvy and aware of what's happening, very believable. I mean, they had processes down to the T. So I tell that story because I do see that across the board. Like, these are cyber criminal groups is a great example of, they're very well organized and they're well funded. And it's sure, can you get away sometimes with the old school stuff of sending some phishing email with a bunch of spelling errors in it? Yeah, maybe sometimes, but the sophistication of calling and either acting like a help desk person or by acting like an executive, or in this case, a credit union, or now even scarier with the ability to use technologies that can mimic the same voice of somebody that is known, or even now video. Those are real things. And so I think, kind of answer your question, is attackers are going to use the tools available to them. And right now we have some very sophisticated technologies that are available. And unfortunately, they usually take advantage of use of those tools, which could also be used for good, faster than the good guys do. So that's a problem. I also think that, it's all about money at the end of the day. Certainly, and I won't discount with more of the nation state actors, they're interested in not just money, but information. But, where we hear a lot of this and what we see in the news is around more of the cyber criminal area. And yeah, I mean, it's a huge market. It's a huge market. And so as long as there's money to be made and money still being made, then it's going to continue to grow and become even more sophisticated.
It just seems like, just when you think you've got the a bit of a grip on it, it ups the game. Like, and then AI comes in last year like a thunderstorm, right? Now all of a sudden, all the bad actors don't spell bad anymore, and their grammar is even better than what you're writing. And you're going, wow, okay, well, can't look at that anymore as an indicator. But now with AI, it seems like they can do a lot more social engineering hits on a larger target audience. than they ever had before, right? They can actually, tell the AI to smash all the stuff that's happening on social with you and come up with a playbook to kind of like keep hitting you from different angles. I mean, man, it's like almost like a bad actor's dream.
Well, I talk about this a lot. I call it the cat and mouse game. And when you can get into the mindset of it is cat and mouse and the chase will always be on, maybe you do sleep better at night because you're never going to be able to stop or prevent all threats. That's just not realistic. And I would caution like anybody that says that they can, because it's not true. And so what you do is you pivot to align to whatever the offense is doing to defend. And when you do that, what you're really doing is you're either preventing or potentially making it harder for them to conduct whatever they're trying to do. And in doing so, now you get to path of least resistance. I think everybody is inherently like, they're going to take the path of least resistance. It's like the laws of nature. And so if it's too hard for the individual to take advantage of that, we'll call it exploit or attack, et cetera, they're going to pivot and go somewhere else. So now you've kind of taken yourself out of that equation. But as more and more of that happens and organizations shore up that defense, well, now the cat and mouse game continues. So attackers pivot. Now we'll go find another way. What's now my path of least resistance? So it's that constant pivot to boost that defense. And we try to get ahead, right? We try to use the technologies for good, but you have to move fast because, like I said, the attackers are going to use the same technologies for bad.
I mean, it seems like they've got their dream is coming true. And I think what's even worse is that they're not even inventing the technology. It's like, they're just like, well, thank you very much. I didn't know we had AI and all these other things we could do with deep fake. So, wow, brilliant, keep it up.
Yeah.
When you look at the world of companies with their cyber, postures and so on, obviously the way I look at it is like a Swiss cheese, right? It's got you got the filled part and you got the gap part, the things with the hole. If you look at the cybersecurity posture of companies in general, how bad are the gaps? How bad are the holes? Are they like, I don't know, 50% there or 80% filled? Like, how bad is it?
That's a good question. I think that the majority of organizations still fail to do what has been initially coined, and I disagree with the term, the basics. It's not basic, it's foundational. It's foundational elements of cybersecurity, which really comes down to one thing, and that is good cybersecurity starts with good IT. And so it's all about hygiene. And so that's the concern that I have, is that as companies grow and expand and merge, et cetera, this decay starts, and you can call it tech debt, what have you, but this decay of IT infrastructure starts, which starts to now introduce new vulnerabilities and risks to the organization, and it's never paid off. And so unless you can continue to keep that positive and good IT hygiene, you're going to accrue these risks. And we try to, I don't know, like you try to, rob Peter to pay Paul with some of the tools out there. And I don't want to discount that. There is definitely some risk mitigation to that, right? Lowering the risk by having various technologies that can protect that IT asset. But at the end of the day, it's still in a state that is not, hygienic. And so that's, to answer your question, that's where I see the issue is maybe the issues are smaller in some organizations versus other, but I think those issues nonetheless are persistent across the majority of organizations. And it all comes down to the foundational elements of good cybersecurity, which starts with good IT.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like now we're at a point, but even if you protected your company with all the best, of everything, and you've got the army of, security professionals monitoring every single dashboard and platforms, and you've got it right now. You got all the supply chain humans right plugged into you, and you become only as strong as the weakest link. So now you got to not just look to see who's attacking you, you got to look to see who's behind you, right? Coming in from your supply chain. And I mean, that's a whole different game, because everybody needs to up their game. Like in this game, like the tide's got to rise, and because all ships are going to float better, you know, for security, if all, you know, ships rise and the tide rises. What do you think about this, the whole thing of the supply chain? Because I know the US government now, you have to have massive compliance right now in your supply chain management, and it's not, you can't just tick the box, right?
Yeah,
you gotta prove it.
You have to prove it. Unfortunately, I think the proof is too administrative versus actionable. And I'll circle back to that here in a second. So I think what good supply chain management looks like should really expand into what just overall what good cybersecurity looks like within an organization. And you put in the preventative defenses that you can. You do the good IT hygiene, like I mentioned. And then for whatever else that you can't prevent, and you're not going to be able to prevent everything, that's where you have good detection mechanisms. And, you know, again, for us at Exabeam, we pride ourselves on being able to detect the number one, you know, root cause of breaches, and that's around compromised credentials. If an attacker compromises credentials, that's what they're going to use to conduct that attack. You want to know about that. So how do you detect that? What we've seen with a lot of these recent breaches is that they are third parties. And so with that is you better be able to identify that third party account and that when it becomes compromised. So I think that good supply chain management needs to expand upon over the, and across just the administrative to, you know, there needs to be a little bit more data sharing and the ability to do some of those integrations where there's good monitoring involved. Because what I don't need to see is how your public posture looks like. I mean, it gives me a sense of how you're doing cybersecurity, but that doesn't tell me whether or not my internal network is going to have a compromise of some sort, whether it be data loss or operational disruption. So I think there needs to be some changes there. But what we've done, we, the industry, have gone, I think, way too far in a direction that is now hurting us, which is this administrative, you know, check boxes. And so now every single organization out there has their version of some spreadsheet or security questionnaire that certainly helps inform them and to make a decision about doing business with one another. But we've created an industry out of it. And I don't necessarily think that it's reducing supply chain risk.
Yeah, we talk about it, compliance as a service. You know, it's gone a little bit haywire. But, you know, I think the challenge too as well, and maybe you agree, Tyler, is like this. It's like everybody needs to like take this stuff seriously, right? Mm-hmm. And everybody's throwing their two cents at it. Okay, well, let's do some compliance here. Let's get some regulations here. Then, of course, you get the insurance companies raising their hands and going, hey, wait a minute. We're not going to insure you, right? Because apparently they're paying out about 65 cents in a dollar right now. Mm-hmm. Which I think no insurance company sleeps at night if they're paying up more than 30 cents in a dollar. Yeah. I could be wrong, but you know they're going crazy, and so now they're trying to figure out like what do we do? And if you took that as an example, insurance companies historically they look at the historic data, right? Like how often a car can be stolen in this neighborhood, and you know where are you located for a hurricane, you know, but in cybersecurity, there is no such thing as historic data. It's like historic is like the last 10 seconds or a nanosecond ago, right? So if you base your premiums on that, well, it's just not going to work. And that's a whole, it's almost like an entire industry shift change in the way they approach cybersecurity. And I think you're right. They haven't woken up yet to this new world that we're living in. And I hope we change. Is there any other data that you've seen in your in the report that is sort of shining light and you know where the gaps are, the problems are that we need to fix?
I think the other one that came out is another pretty top major finding is around the visibility aspect. And again, you have these survey takers that are saying that we are very confident in our ability to detect this or respond to that, and yet when you get down to the visibility piece, it's, you know, 60 something percent of visibility in the network. So how can one say that when you can't even see your entire your organization, and you question, well, you know, why is that, and what authority and power does the CISO have with, or the security program have within the organization to expand into these other areas that they're, you know, close to 40% of their organization they're not even monitoring at all.
They don't even know what they have, right? I mean, I've actually seen the looks in people's faces after they do a discovery, you know, assessment, and they would like, they don't even acknowledge that they missed like half of the stuff that they have. Mm-hmm. They mm-hmm. say that can't be true. It's yep. it's impossible. It's like almost like a denial syndrome. But then they peel back the end and they realize that humans are walking into the offices and downloading apps and doing this yep. and whatever else they're doing. And no one has a kind of a grasp on it. And, right. and therefore it just sort of like becomes this massive shadow IT gig. And of course, I mean, I think you'd agree, you can't protect what you don't see. Do you see, I mean, how do you solve that? Do you any ideas of how you could solve that?
I mean, from a more of an infrastructure side and with physical assets, certainly there's ways to do one example, like certificate-based authentication, but various authentication mechanisms just to restrict what can actually connect to the network. But what I think was more important here, and the other area that we haven't talked about, is like with all the SaaS solutions out there, SaaS is the new operating system and everybody's using it. So if everyone's using it, that's where the attackers are going to go as well. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, maybe something that most CISOs won't say is, instead of trying to standardize on various applications, don't do that. I acknowledge that complexity can be the enemy of security, but I think we need to meet the business where they're at. And the business is going to want to use some of these really neat tools out there. And if you don't embrace that and find ways to protect it, it does become shadow IT, or it does become some security risk, or in some cases, you know, it's a financial risk as well, because now you have three functional areas within your organization using a similar tool, and they don't even know that they're all using the same type of capability, and you could standardize. So I think meeting them where they're at and embracing some of those solutions, certainly still do your risk assessments and everything, but that's a big area for me of like not trying to control it all, but actually saying, hey, I'm here to partner with you, but we got to put, you know, some minimal controls in, is very important.
I think that's smart, because I know last time I checked, pretty hard to keep humans in a box. You know, and it seems to me the more you say no, the more they do it. So, yep. You know, embrace the chaos and figure a way to wrap something around it. Yep. What about automation? I know your studies found some findings on automation. Like, are we there? Are we using enough? Like, what does that look like in the world of cyber?
Yeah, with automation, I'll first note that I think a lot of people, when you hear the word automation, think of SOAR. And when you think of SOAR, you think of, okay, what are the response actions like at the end of an incident to clean up or to contain? And what we're trying to say here at Exabeam is that automation is a lot more than just that. What we saw in the survey is that, yeah, a lot of people say that they're automating, but then when you start to peel back the onion of, well, how do you define automation? I think that's where the meaty stuff comes from. And what we you know, kind of talk, when we talk about automation, what we're talking about is automation from really alert all the way to the end of a security incident, and being able to, and where analysts spend the majority of their time is just trying to understand, I'll simplify it, what the hell is going on. They want to know what the hell is going on. And so being able to automate the triage of that incident, to grab all the necessary information to be able to summarize that in a very easily digestible format for the person to thus make a decision on what next steps need to happen, whether it be containment or some other sort of mitigation. That's what Exabeam is focused on as a major piece of automation. That's what, when we talk about automation, that's a big piece there of being able to help the analysts. That's, like I said, most of their time is spent in that area, and we want to automate that.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I want to come back to, I want to talk about AI a little bit, how all this stuff is changing with AI. But I want to talk about your experience as a, you know, so breaches happen, right? So let's say you get a breach, right? And it's a big one. It's not just somebody tinkering around. What do you do? What's your playbook? Like, what do you, is there a book you open and you say, okay, like I'm about to crash this plane, just check this. What does that look like? Everybody should have a plan, of course, right? But what does it look like from your perspective, knowing the things that you've seen?
Yeah, there's been a lot of discussions and everything on playbooks. And of course, you have your technical playbooks and what you run to again and investigate the issue and start to resolve the incident from again from a technical perspective. But at like a CISO level, at a business level, I think the playbooks are important. I don't necessarily agree with having playbooks for every. You can't one create one for every single scenario, but two, to me, there really is no difference in some of those playbooks to begin with. So I try to really condense it down into major topic areas, whether that be, I'll give you two examples, whether it be, you know, an internal breach like you mentioned, or maybe it's a report on a 0-day vulnerability. It's not a data breach, but you better believe that we're going to respond to it in a way that is going to involve multiple areas of the business. And you can imagine that customers are going to want to be asking, are you vulnerable to this? What are you doing about it? Et cetera. So we do have to respond and treat it like it would be a major data breach. So first on the playbook side, you know, try to consolidate and condense it in these major areas. And then from there, yeah, we would follow that. And whether it be on the response side of understanding, okay, for production, these are our key stakeholders. This is, you know, all the processes that we'd follow here. Here's all of the reference documentation that we need to really understand and make those decisions to the communication side and what they would be responsible for. When are we supposed to be communicating, et cetera? So, I digress. Stakeholders, right? Understanding your stakeholders, and most importantly, is like you do need to have a plan, and that all falls under our crisis management plan and being able to respond when, you know, the stuff does hit the fan.
And but I think everybody, obviously, you know, everybody's got to have a plan, right? And the challenge is that from what I've heard, and I don't know this because no one will actually share, you know, what their plan is, right? In general, but not everybody's that prepared, right? It's like we have a general thing, there's a little playbook and you know what they're doing, but you know, there's a lot of other things. For example, one of the things I heard is that you can't use the same communication tools that you're using if you have a massive breach, right? Because maybe that's being monitored or something, right? So I go, well, so I would ask that question to companies. I mean, you got, you know, you have an alternative way of communicating. They go, why? What do you mean? And so I don't know if they've gotten the memo yet or not, but it seems like they maybe also need to dust off their current playbook and figure out if it's actually current.
I not only the playbook itself, but there's major decisions that will need to happen. And so I think it's more of defining those decision points and then who's going to be the decision maker. So one example that I've seen in the past is around ransomware. And so, you know, I won't say where, but we were conducting a tabletop exercise once, and it was on ransomware, and that question or that decision point came up. So the first question is, are we going to pay it? If we had to pay it, are we going to pay it? And that already sparked a little bit of this with senior leadership and the board on whether or not we would. But more importantly, it came down to, well, who's going to approve if we did pay it, and how much would we pay? And so that came down to the board saying the board needs to make that decision. The CEO saying no, the CEO and management will make that decision. And as the CISO, I'm saying, you two parties need to figure that out. Like, that's a very important decision that will need to be made if this ever happens. And it's totally possible that it can happen. So I need that information, because in a real world scenario, we can't be bickering about who's going to make the call here. We needed to find that now. So I would challenge, you know, folks even listening to this today, of identifying what are those key decisions in your organizations that need to be ironed out now, so that they're not being bickered over during a real crisis.
That's really great advice, because I think people just sort of kick it down the road. We'll get there when we get there, but I think they also underestimate, Tyler, the complexities and the difficulties of those decisions, right?
Yep.
I mean, yep. At any point in time, that decision could even change, right? Because right. I don't know how well the company is doing, how bad the economy is doing, if there's another war, I don't know. I mean, there could be many, many things that will actually change that decision in real mm-hmm. time at that point in time, right? Sure. So sure. It's almost like a moving target, right?
Absolutely. And the other big one is around materiality. And that's something for a public organization, you obviously need to define. But even for private organizations, it's equally as important to define, because a ransomware payment of $200,000 may not be material to the organization, but maybe $1 million is. And so does that change the decision? Does that change who the decision maker is? And it's not just ransomware, but any decision may have a financial impact. And whether or not that impact is material to the organization, you got to do your homework now, CISOs. I put together an adverse impact table just to understand all of those various facets, so I know what is material to our organization. Where can I make decisions on risk tolerance versus where it could exceed my area of authority, and, you know, management or the board, et cetera, needs to make that decision. And I need to arm them with that information about, hey, this is actually material.
Yeah. And not when it's actually burning, you know. It's like, exactly. You got to also look at the fact that, in the public arena, right, all these companies are public and the word is going to get out no matter what. And right. What is the impact of that from your customer base, from governmental reporting basis, and then privacy issues? I mean, man, you go down the rabbit hole, you definitely, it's a complex thing. Mm-hmm. Last thing I want to jump into, and then we could just, first of all, is there any other data points that you want to mention that came out of the report that we haven't already?
So we talked about the overconfidence. We talked about the visibility. I think we talked about the automation. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. I think, again, like, I do see that organizations are leveraging new tools and technologies that, like we talked about, the bad actors are too, but I think that they are starting to leverage these technologies better. I think that they are really, I think it's just in general that the report has prompted us to question what an effective security posture is. So we have this almost pervasive lack of awareness among professionals about this full spectrum of even solutions that are out there and available in the market today, that can help. And you have that knowledge gap that hinders what could be effective evaluation adoption of technologies, again, where possible. And then, like I mentioned earlier, you also have these areas of risk that are around the foundational elements of cybersecurity, which the survey didn't necessarily poke at, but we did see it from the threat detection investigation response side.
Well, I mean, I would recommend to everybody to kind of pay close attention to these things, because, you know, we kind of guess a lot of stuff. You know, we think we know that, we think that works like that, whatever. But in reality, unless you kind of see where the market is and how the humans are thinking between their perception and reality, and unfortunately, you know, your perception is not reality, right? You need to figure out what's real, because I guarantee you the bad actors are counting on your perception being bad. And they're realizing that your reality is much worse. And that's the advantage, that's the battlefield, right? That they get to play in, I think.
Yeah, we're just measuring ourselves, you know, across these conventional and legacy benchmarks. And unless you embrace a more comprehensive approach to security, the metrics that we've used, particularly for security operations, just really aren't going to work anymore to show the true capability of your security operations program.
Yeah. Bad actors don't come from the front, man, when you have all your guns pointed. You know, they're going to figure out your weakest point and go there. But yeah, I'm not in the game, so I really don't know. AI is one of the, you know, rounded up with AI. I mean, of course, all cyber companies are using AI into their solution, a lot of automation around AI. We know bad actors are using AI. What's your take on how AI is going to be good, bad, indifferent? Do we have to be better at AI than the bad actors? Like, how do you see AI fitting into the whole cybersecurity game?
Like, I don't think it's any different than any tool. And like I mentioned earlier, it's just how quickly is the organization willing and able to embrace some of the technologies, because, you know, newsflash, the bad actors are. So if you're not going to, then you better figure out a different way to defend against that. And I think it would be very difficult when they're using these new technologies, as we've seen. So I would, you know, again, meet the business where it is, just like with the SaaS solutions, meet the business where it is and embrace some of these technologies, because not only can they be used for good in collaboration, they can be used for good in product development. It could be used for good for product features and new capabilities that can be leveraged by customers. And so all of those things are good if you embrace and move at a swift pace, I'd say, but be aware of those risks, whether it be AI being used to fish somebody, to where someone's trying to poison AI. And so you need to be aware of that entire risk landscape and be implementing various controls to mitigate that risk.
And I also heard from another CISO recently that people use AI, right, to, you know, make presentations and the usual, mm-hmm. writing better and so on, for good reasons, right? But then what they put in there can actually put their company at risk, because they're putting certain things in, yeah. in that AI that others can access, right? Especially, yep. if it's in the public arena. And there's an incident that I'm going to be digging in more into later on, that it makes you vulnerable in a different way, that you think you're doing something innocent by trying to get a great presentation out of AI, but then, you know, other people get hands on it, and then they can leverage it against your organization. So I caution everybody how to do it. I mean, you can't not use it, but just being aware, I think, that these things do impact what's going on. I'll leave you with the last word, Tyler. Is there something that I should have asked you that I haven't yet asked you that everybody out there should know?
I think you hit on the majority of the areas that I like to stand on soapboxes on. You know, I just would close with, again, like, it doesn't matter if you're a CISO, security professionals in general, don't lose sight that there's no finish line. And it's a journey, and you have to be agile. And if you can get that mindset, I think you can sleep at night. Like I said, there's some things that come up throughout the day, but I think if you have that mindset and you're there because you want to be there, you're doing this, you're in cybersecurity because you want to do this, and you're aware of that this is a never-ending, constantly evolving role and landscape. You know, you play till you don't want to play anymore. And what you're playing is that cat and mouse game.
Good stuff, man. The battle continues, right, Tyler? And fight a good fight today. Get some rest, because tomorrow it's for sure the fight starts again.
Exactly.
And so be well rested. Get a exactly. good night's sleep, because you will need it. The enemy is always figuring out, hey, let me just wear you down until mm-hmm. you just can't get any more. So fight a good fight. The website address for everybody to learn more, or maybe get in more information about the report. What is that?
Yeah. So we have, if you want to learn more about Exabeam, you can go to exabeam.com. And in fact, if you want to get in touch with anybody here, you can go to exabeam.com/contact/get-in-touch. For the report itself, you can go to exabeam.com/state-of-the-threat-detection-investigation-response.
Done. We'll drop the links in there as well, so in case you don't want to type all those words, but good stuff. Tyler, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining me. It's, you've got a wealth of information, and you know our job is really just to try to pick your brains and hopefully share the information and help push back, you know, on that cybercrime as and live to fight another day.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Julian.
Thank you. Cheers.